Okay, let's get going. This is the class on revision, and before we get going, let me give you a URL online. My website is steveboy.com. The reason I'm giving that to you is because on my blog, I did a 7-part series of posts that's more generally what I'm talking about today, where I take a page of a draft that I'm working on and revise it and break it up and talk about why I made the changes I made. Now, it's a little more specific to me and how I work, trying to address to other writers, you know, what might work for them. And while I'm going to revise some of my first draft here, which is me showing you in my underwear, it's not a pretty... Oh, thanks. And you know this because... I'm a boxer briefs guy.
Right, see, that's better.
Yeah, that's an indecisive sort of person, I guess. My reason in doing that, okay, is not just to do stunt revising. It's, you know, besides showing you the method to my madness, really the implicit thing is, look, you know, I do this for a living, and I've done it for many years, and trust me, my first draft is usually not something I would want to show a room full of people. And part of what I want to try to convey to you here is that you can give yourself permission to suck. It is okay. If without that, I would never get anything done. And the reason I think that is important is because if you're talented, if you have objectives, you know, you want to be a perfectionist. You want it to just be great right out the gate. And guess what? That doesn't happen often. And when you get mad at yourself, you know, you write something, you're like, this just sucks. You know, and you get up and make a ham sandwich and that's it, you're done, right? Or, you know, there's, you know, usually at the computer, so you're like, I don't know, what's on hotcheerleaders.com today or whatever it is. And, you know, you don't, not that I go there, but a friend of mine. The thing is when you hit that wall, you don't produce, you don't make stuff, you know? And earlier on, when I both before I was being published and even for some time afterward, I would write in these binges. I'd write like 100 pages in 3-4 days. And then I wouldn't do anything for 6 months, you know? And you can't really, that just doesn't work out well. It doesn't. I mean, both practically speaking in terms of a career, but even artistically, you know, the mechanism gets rusty. And not to sound tautological, but the more you write, the more you write. That machinery stays lubricated. And what I've learned is if you will let yourself do something that isn't necessarily great, it is much easier to make it good later on than it is to make it in the first place. So if you allow yourself the permission that, if you give yourself the understanding that there is an impetus in you, right, that wants to put this down. Maybe it's not well formed now, but you know, Jan in her speech wonderfully said, you know, these things grow from shit, right? They don't grow from nothing. So if you have to produce shit to make something good later on, let yourself do it. No one's gonna see it except for idiots like me showing it to you today, okay? But it's hard to accept. I mean, it really is. It's hard to read something you did and go, who am I kidding? You know, but I have grown to, you know, when you first start, I mean, you're writing in that white hot fever of creation and you're just so enthused and passionate. But I've come to like revision much more than the initial act of writing. Revision to me is creative. Revision is where you take that hunk of marble that looks kind of like a guy and turn it into Michelangelo's David. That's really, Michelangelo doesn't go, it's a done, you know, right? So, I mean, we'd like to believe that, but it's just not true. You know, in my career, I mean, since I started writing as a little kid, I think twice I have written things that came out of, you know, out of the keyboard and into the world that I didn't change, twice. And I've written a lot of stuff. So, it's an unreasonable expectation to think you're not going to have to do this. And revision affords you enormous opportunities. So before I get to this, I'm going to talk about practical and abstract reasons why we do this, okay? Practically speaking, of course, you correct mistakes, right? Grammar, punctuation, spelling, and all that other stuff. I had proofreader's marks that I gave out, and I think they all went away to other people. I urge you to learn proofreader's marks. They're usually at the beginning of the writer's market, definitely in the AP style guides. Part of the practical reason for that is if you work with publishers later, you will get your galleys back, you will get a copy edited manuscript, and your corrections ought to be in standard proofreader's marks, because that's how they're going to know. So it's a good skill to have. It's also good for you later, because you'll know what the hell. Trust me, if you come back to this 6 months from now, you want to know what you meant when you made changes. So practically speaking, there's that. It's an opportunity to clean up your language. By that, I don't mean take out the dirty words. To change your language for clarity, often in our description and especially in our action, it can be vague, it can be confusing, or you just haven't succinctly said the thing you want to say. You've danced around it because it wasn't clear in your head, so you've used 30 words for the 3 words that would have done it, right? So it's an opportunity, you know, to look. Always look at simplification. Always look at paring down. How can I convey this trenchantly? Mark Twain said, eschew surplusage. and brevity, you know, in connotation with that. You know, I mean, am I trying too hard to give the reader information? Is there too much exposition? Is my dialogue really just purely informative and serves no other purpose? How can I say anything simpler? You know, when am I just going on? I get too detail-oriented because I'm dealing a lot of fantasy stuff. I try to make that as realistic as possible, and I tend to hypertrophy that muscle, and sometimes you need to back away from that. I have on my bulletin board a little thing from a fortune cookie that says, forget the details if they cloud the picture. So that's a good thing to look at when you revise, is do I need to say this? And that can be on a sentence basis and on a chapter basis. What purpose does this chapter serve? Do I just want to see what happens when this guy goes to McDonald's, or does he gotta go to McDonald's, right? Another reason, practical reason for your revision is sequencing. Now, I mean sequencing on a word-by-word basis, right? How does the order of these words convey the information? Again, clarity. But also, you know, and I taught this yesterday in the class on lyric prose, beauty. You know, how do I make this, can this sound nice? You know, is there a way of rearranging this that actually sounds better? Or, you know, I'm real big on reading your work out loud, because if it sounds clunky, that should tell you something. Is there a more elegant way to put this? You know, good writing generally sounds good. So, you know, reading with your ear as well as your eye can help you with that as well. So by sequencing on a word-by-word basis, that's what I mean. But I also mean sequencing in terms of events. Sometimes in your head, you know you have an objective. You want something to happen. And so that gets down on the page fast. And then kind of the logical arrangement of event will follow, you know, where really you either want to lead to it better or you want to state it at the right point. So timing is very important. You know, and taking a look at, there's a kind of momentum in a sentence, right? A sort of natural progression of event, order, logic, information, sound, all of these things. And you want to be sure that that momentum doesn't have speed bumps in it. So, he said, Cuisinarting his metaphors. So, I'm surprised how often an entire line or paragraph will be moved in my stuff. As if everything is there completely but strangely jumbled. It's weird to me how complete it is and yet not necessarily linear. So that's something to keep in mind. The logic of order of events, right? pardon me. I've been talking all weekend long, so I'm going to sound like Tom Waits by Monday.
Do you want some water?
Huh? Oh, I have some. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much. The other practical reason is theme. Revision is an opportunity for you to reinforce thematic elements, to foreshadow, to draw those threads through the tapestry of your manuscript script that later people are like, what a clever person you are. It's like that was all there. And you say, why, thank you. You know, sometimes your book will tell you its themes and you're not you need to pay attention to that. I mean, books can really knock on your head and say, no, I'm about this. Turns out you hate your life. Whatever, right? And you really should pay attention to that, because things that surface, both in terms of character detail, of event, and thematically, if you have some axe to grind or some feeling that you want to maintain or recall, this is your opportunity to find those. Now, that there's an aesthetic to that, your sense of timing, when should this occur, and only you can know that. But that's also why God made the search function, right? If there's a magic ring and you need it to show up sometimes, it's kind of good to search the word ring and see if maybe there's a couple hundred pages sometimes between. And that can be true for details, elements, thematic stuff. If you write mysteries or thrillers, I'm sure it's a lifesaver, because you need to reinforce things. You know, books are a very long process. And, you know, your readers aren't stupid, but it's nice to help them along sometimes. I mean, even like in The Lord of the Rings, if you want to keep that ring example, he needs to trot the ring out every once. You need to be reminded of what T.S. Eliot called the objective correlative, this thing that is freighted with drama and meaning and history. So he trots it out as a threat all the time. If they just tell you at the beginning and then you run through the book, it starts to lose its significance. So these things are true of character details. You know, look at this. That's a lot of information. So helping people with it is a good thing. So that's, to me, practical stuff, okay? More abstractly, I touched on this earlier on, is your issue of productivity. If you are willing to revise, it makes you more willing to not be perfect out the gate. You will produce more, which is always a good thing, especially if you are trying to pay your rent with what is coming out of your head. Michelangelo once ostensibly said, I don't know why everybody thinks this is so hard. I just carve away everything that isn't a horse. And, you know, that sounds glib, but I totally agree with that. You have to know what's a horse. You've got all of these words. You have to know what isn't contributing to the thing you want to say, the feeling you want to convey. Information, beauty, all these things. It's okay to indulge yourself. You know, being pretty isn't necessary. Beauty isn't necessary. You know, we're not talking about nuclear survival stuff you put in your bomb shelter. We're talking about, you know, adorning things sometimes. So you don't strip away everything. Then you end up sounding like Hemingway, because that's what minimalists do. They take away everything that they don't need and they all sound the same. So what I mean by that is have, you know, in your core, in your heart, knowing, even if you can't articulate it, the sense of what you want this to be, how you want it to feel, what is the impression you want it to make upon the reader. And with that sense, that acts as a filter and a guide, a compass for you as you revise. And it helps you to know what doesn't contribute to that. So it's kind of hard to reduce your story, your book, down to something like that. And it's very hard to articulate it, but you'll know it. You'll know it by what doesn't fit it. You know, that's the sensibility you learn, and it's different for every one of you. Just on a personal note, I learned not to throw away stuff. I once wrote something that was the beginning of a novel, and I looked at it and went, wow, this is birdcage liner. and I tossed it. I'm never going to. And then, like, literally, like 20 years later, I got this idea for something, and I went, hey, that's really great. And there was stuff in that that would really work here. And I went, and it's gone. Right? So not even just the immediate project you're working on, you know, has value, that has a momentum, but you might, you know, something in your head wanted to tell that. And maybe it wasn't ready. Maybe it went down a blind alley. But later on, something in you might be able to mind that. So I keep stuff. You know, I revisit it, and maybe you don't ever use it, but it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it, right? So just for what it's worth, especially in a digital age when, you know, everything you ever write in your life can be held in a thumb drive and lost on a thumb drive, you know, keep stuff. It's okay. More abstract thing, and this is a biggie for me, I'm really big on verisimilitude, some semblance of expertise on what I'm writing about. Often with that, especially because if you write fantasy, you know, I'm shoveling loads of bullshit here sometimes, and having the correct concrete details, you know, that real foot in the door kind of lets me shovel, you know, sometimes. But sometimes you're like, you know, I don't mean you have to learn martial arts to write a fight scene, okay? But if you want believability and authority, the sense of expertise, you will sometimes go out and research. I highly recommend that you research things like this, because trust me, maybe you don't know what you're talking about, but sooner or later you'll get an email from somebody who does. And he will say, you are full of crap. And what's easy to do is stop and go, oh man, I don't know a thing about this. And you know, you get online, you go to the library, you go running around, or geographically, landscape is very important to me. So I'll get in the car and I'll take off, or, you know, spend money I don't have. You know, spend $500 to find out what the sign looks like in some corner or something. And you're like, really? I did that for this detail and I didn't write during all this time. Right? So don't stop for that is really what I'm saying more simply. Go ahead and bullshit. It's okay. No one will see that later. You can even start making, you know, I in boldface in brackets will put insert authoritative stuff here, you know, find out more about this, whatever. I mean, it's okay. Come back to it, right? Sometimes it'll send ripples through the rest of the book. What you learn will make changes, but that's good. I know it's work, but letting fact determine the outcome is wonderful. Sometimes it's determined the climax of books for me. But my point is, don't stop. Don't hit a wall. Go ahead and blather. Just don't send the blather out later on, okay? Change it later. You know, you're probably not going to be so off base that it'll make you rewrite the book. You probably have some general sense. You know, I stopped cold on this thing about a year ago because there was a scene involving hyenas, and it's a sort of post-apocalyptic thing, and the animals have escaped from the zoo, and I'm just like, I'm going to have to talk out my ass for a few pages here because I really don't know. And I didn't want to stop and research and watch lots of videos and then talk to people and all that. I just went ahead and wrote it. And I was wrong, but only in what was missing, not, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But then you find that one detail that makes people go, that dude knows hyenas, right? So, woo-hoo. So, that's Steve Boyette. He's a hyena expert. So what's the through line here, right? Don't stop. Don't let this stop you, you know? And, you know, I know that it's a quality versus quantity issue. You always want it to be quality. But again, you know, the writer in you, the more you write, the easier it is to write, you know? And the more you will develop a sure instinct for what should go there, what doesn't, you know? To the extent that I tend to know it as I write now, you know, I'll sort of stop at the sentence level and see where that's going. That, you know, the part of me that knows he's going to have to revise it later goes, no, let's do that now. So maybe it slows me up a little, but I'm approaching it with a sort of revisionist sensibility. I don't know how common that is, but it works for me. When I was going over pages that I was going to do this on, I noticed that in 400 and something pages of manuscript here that's not done, there was one page that didn't have marks on it. I revise as I go, and everything looks like this, right? It just looks like my pen had some sort of diarrhea. Leave notes, leave post-its, write all over, whatever you need to do, whatever works for you, you know? What's weird to me is I come back 6 months later and I don't remember them. And it is really like reading suggestions from someone you don't know. You don't remember writing it, and sometimes you're like, what the hell does this guy know? I mean, you disagree with yourself, you know, that's okay. You know, so maybe you didn't have your cornflakes this morning, whatever reason it is. Yes?
Do you revise on the hard copy and not on the computer?
I do.
Is there a reason?
I have come to think that there is a reason. I write on legal pads. And then I type 110 words a minute, so I could fly. But I find that there is a pace. Different books want to be done at different paces for me. Mostly, I've done things entirely on the keyboard, and I do sections on keyboards when I'm like, that is just there in my head. But mostly I find that pace works really well for me. It seems to want to unspool at that. And then I enter it into the keyboard, take it with me the next day when I go to work on something, revise it, and then go on. I like the momentum because it's easier to revise and then continue. I also, this is a little off the track, but I highly recommend not painting yourself in corners when you stop. Don't end a section, don't end a chapter. End in the middle of a sentence. And the next day, it is much easier to pick up on that. You know, if you complete something and go, man, that's just satisfying. And then the next day you're like, ah, now what? You know, but for me, that's a little trick that helps me kind of keep going. Even when I know I could finish this section, sometimes I'll stop a little early, which is unusual for me because I belong to the Church of Immediate Gratification. But but in the long run, yeah, that's really good for you.
I have read that some experts on writing suggest that you do the revisions in a sort of hierarchical staging where you look first at big issues, concept, structure, and then go back. What I find myself doing...
It's not bad advice. I think you should do what works for you, but I definitely... It's good to make passes. You know, I do what I call a continuity pass, which is, okay, we cut off his left hand, and let's see if it's always the left hand that's gone throughout the book, yeah. Right? A detail pass, right? Because that's a little easier. You know, the aesthetician in you wants to make it pretty all the time, and you can become sidetracked as you read by, oh man, I need to change. So having the focus to go, I'm going to do a detail pass, you know, a continuity pass. I do like to do a strict proofread as opposed to edit, you know, for that reason. It's easier to focus. So I do think that's good advice. Nowadays, I tend to just, you know, do whatever the hell. I tend to remember it pretty well. Yeah.
I mean, would you advise as young writers if we were just to, like, dump the whole book out and then go back and do all those things or kind of take a look-see chapter by chapter?
Especially for, that's a really good question. For me, I can only tell you for me, mm-hmm. I like having this on hand. I like...
What, the whole thing?
I sometimes make notes that refer back to things.
Okay.
I view this as a process, right? For me, I mean, look, I used to word process for a living, and I'm very, very computer literate, and God knows in, you know, an hour I'm going to be dissembling about digital media, but I still find, for me, this process, it just is more, it's more spontaneous. I it's easier to annotate, it's easier to look through, it's easier to say, do this on page 34. I can do that a lot faster than I can on a computer. So for me, the object to write on. Plus, I was a proofreader for many years, and that's just a habit I've gotten into. But honestly, if it works for you to stay on that screen, whatever is comfortable for you, you know. But that's a great question. I like the whole thing out because I'm real big on resonance, you know, and little subtle things. And you know, a lot of people don't pick up on them. The thing is when you have little jewels for readers, they're like, ooh, you know. I mean, I like that as a reader, and that tends to need the big picture, right? So for me, that's an excellent question. Yeah.
Do you ever pretend to be someone else while you're editing your own work? Just trying to
not so much pretend to, but there is like an editor part of my head, definitely. And the thing to do is get him drunk while you're writing. Send that son of a bitch to Tahiti. give him an open credit card and, you know, whatever the hell he needs. Because his opinion doesn't mean a damn thing to you while you're making stuff, you know. I've at least learned that he's an ally. You'll notice even as I talk, right, I've partitioned that. But the writer part of me are partitioned too. You know, I make a living as DJ, as a club-style DJ as well. So these are parts, I'm very compartmentalized. I think that... if it helps you to actually put on an editor's hat, you know, metaphorically or literally, I'd love to design an editor's hat, mm-hmm. because it would leave red ink stains on whoever wears it. I think that's a good idea. The hard part with your work is approaching objectivity, you know. Because, you know, anytime you think, man, that's the best damn sentence I ever read, you probably should get rid of it. You know? Anytime you're just taken with your own genius, that editor needs to know when to bitch slap you down. I mean, you really need to be ruthless with yourself and honest with yourself. And you need to not pollute that editor part of you. You must trust it. You must not let it write the book. but you've definitely got to hand the reins over to that person. And for me, again, I've grown comfortable enough with it that, you know, I'll let him sit on my shoulder as I work, and he's like, you know, you don't want that word. But rather than stop cold and go, what word do I want? If I don't know, I'll put a bracket. And I'll say, you know, I have this weird little annotation thing I do now, and I'll put a bracket with two underlines, meaning I want a two-syllable word there for the rhythm of the sentence. Oh. And so I do things like that rather than stop. I don't mind, you know, or I'll just say yada yada or whatever and come back. I know what I want there. Anything else? These are great questions. I love the questions from the people at this thing because they're not like beginner questions. Yeah.
I must have edited my book 15 times already, and I find that sometimes I get caught up in the story and forget I'm editing.
Well, for what it's worth, if you're caught up in the story and the writing isn't standing out for you, maybe it's the editor's time, you know, sign that you should leave it the hell alone. You know, that's okay. You just need to know when you are sort of singing yourself a lullaby about your stuff. You know, early on, I mean, I don't know how long you've been writing or whatever, but early on, the whole process is just so enamoring. You know, you're like, wow, look, I'm making stuff, you know? I mean, it's seductive and hypnotic, but it really is, I mean, it feels magical, you know? And it still does to me, but you get used to it. It's part of your job in a way. And you can't be distracted by that. You must acquire the reader in you, you know, who approaches this as if it's written by someone else. And that's hard. I mean, I don't have good advice for that because it's hard. And I just think doing it over and over again, getting used to that voice. And sadly, I guess in a certain sense, letting that magic become kind of mundane to you will give you some distance, you know. But again, it's not necessarily that it's bad, right? You know, maybe what you're reading doesn't need to be fixed. I have that, you know, where you're like, but it's weird when you run across it. You're like, okay, what's wrong? I don't want to change this. Anything else before I start spilling red ink all over my stuff?
I want to know how to deal with the whining child in me that says, oh my God, I got 5 years in this and I'm still revising and I'm still not happy, but I'm fighting myself that I can't.
Toulouse-Lautrec said that art is never finished, it is only abandoned. You know, the best example I can give you is George Lucas. He has the resources to keep changing the same goddamn movie over and over. And what do all of us think? George, get over it. Why don't you make another movie and show us you've actually learned something since then, right? You know, and the thing to do is you've got to accept that the proof you have learned is your dissatisfaction with earlier work. You know, my first novel, Ariel, is up here. I wrote it when I was 19 years old, right? People, you know, come up, they say, man, I really like this, or blah, blah, blah. I'm very flattered by it, but I feel as if somebody's complimenting me on the girlfriend I had many years ago. I see why I went out with her. I wouldn't date her now. So you have to, you know, I mean, God help you if you think something you wrote 30 years ago is the best thing you ever wrote, right? So that's okay. It's proof you're learning. So you need to accept that, you know, you're going to have to let go. You've got to dress that kid and send him off to school and hope he's got the wherewithal not to get the shit beat out of him. Because guess what? Once you release that book to the world, welcome to digital bullyism, you know? I mean, and you've just got to accept it. You've got to know when to let it go. And that is a very personal.
Very personal. How do you know when?
Man, that is so subjective.
How do you know when with a kid?
I'll tell you what, even the best book to the writer was just, it's good enough. You know, the most recent book I published, Mortality Bridge, took me 25 years to get in print. I started it in 1987, I think. It took 6 years to write the first draft. I wrecked my life to write that book. I would not take any permanent job because that book owned me. That book was the junkie who, you know, who you were in love with, who says, I'm in town. And you're like, I'm in my car. Here I go. Right? I just couldn't stay away from it. And then I rewrote it, I'd say, 35 times. And I knew, you know, I kept insisting, this book is fine, this book is fine, what's the problem, you know? But I knew something in me wasn't ready for it. I knew that I had taken on something that I had to grow in some way to justify what I was doing here. I had to become the equal of the book, and that's a weird I wouldn't admit it.
Yeah.
But then I set it aside for years. I rewrote it, sent it to my agent. My agent said, I think you should tell it chronologically, because it had been, and I had resisted, I'd thought of that, I'd resisted it, because I didn't want to write the connective stuff, and I thought, no, it's perfect, blah, 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 right? And I realized, I'm ready to do that. And I sat down and rewrote it, and after 35 drafts, 25, I went, it's done. I mean, I knew it was done. And so some of it is self-recognition. It's not the work, it's knowing who you are in your approach to this. Is this what I wanted?
Journey,
you know, I really didn't mean for this to be like, you know, we can all do a group hug. But the truth is, the flaws in the image are the flaws in the lens, right?
Wow.
And that doesn't mean you have to be a perfect person. Picasso was a son of a bitch. You know, Faulkner was a lout. You know, Fitzgerald was a cad. You don't have to be a great person to write great stuff. But you do need a certain empathy. You need to know honestly what your shortcomings are, what your strengths are. And there's a certain arrogance in thinking, yeah, I'm going to sit on my butt and do this for a year and people are going to want to read that. Right? So you need that sensibility in yourself. That's part of revision, you know. But again, it all comes back to your image of the book, your sense of the truth of what you are trying to convey. And that's, I really don't mean to sound metaphysical, but that's such a personal thing. You've got to be really honest with yourself, you know. And it's hard when you're starting out because, you know, it's like your first love. You're so infatuated. You just got no perspective. And unfortunately, it's repetition, you know, that dulls your heart enough to... Plus, you know, publishing will also sandpaper your heart enough that...
Steve, if I may, I have a sort of a more mechanical version of the same question, and that would be, you know, at some point when you're writing and you're rewriting, let's say, the most important page in the world, times maybe 20, I mean, at what point do you, as your editor, as your own editor, say, you know, enough Pardon. Is enough, when, in my case, a second set of eyes will always help?
Well, I think that can be part of your process, is... If you have trusted friends that you ask to read your stuff, never, ever argue with them, even if you vehemently disagree, because you need honest opinions. Right. You don't want anyone to soft sell. So, I mean, that can be part of your process, especially if you're not sure. Right. It's, you know, how does this work for you? As an, I mean, yeah, those people are very valuable to you. You know, I tend to do strong openings, so it's not as easy for me to talk about. I tend to have a good sense of where to start books and good hooks and things like that. But it's part of the same perspective, the distance that's necessary. It's so hard to approach it with fresh eyes as if you are reading it for the first time. And that's that editor that you have to develop. And it does get hard. I mean, Ariel, the first novel, I can't reread it. It's tattooed in my brain. I, you know, when somebody says a word over and over, you're like, it doesn't mean anything anymore. And it gets that way for me. But there's an editor in me who I can read that book now and go, oh yeah, I could do this and this and that to it. I just know that. Hmm. So, like, I don't read it as a consumer, from an enjoyment perspective. But again, it's that strange partitioning, right? There's an editor in you that it doesn't matter if he's bored. You know, I mean, again, for me, I've worked as an editor, I've worked as a proofreader, so I'm kind of used to reading stuff that I don't even, like, for meaning is not part of it. You're looking at it, what's it doing to me? What's happening in the process here? So I can kind of distance myself that way, and maybe it's the familiarity of doing that. It's a good question and a difficult one. Yeah?
How do you get the distance to evaluate pace in the book?
It's a good question, and I don't talk about pace a lot on revision. Off the cuff, I think I would have two answers to that. One is, revision with brevity in mind. You know, if too much detail, vague action, things like that, will definitely muddy your pace. They definitely slow things down. You know, the ways in which you're giving information, the appropriateness of the timing in giving your information, right? Pace is really, when you think about it, because this is a linear process, right? Pace is an illusion created by the tension of the words, by the dynamics of the events, by the ways in which your sentences are structured. For instance, action scenes to me are really good for run-on sentences and then bam, short sentences that with the punctuated with the actual events. So I look at that sort of thing. how I've approached it. So in terms of bloat, right, you know, carving away the fat and things like that. Then the other issue, of course, is sequencing, right? What you're talking about is timing. So the decisions you make about when to put the information down, you need to go, okay, you know, I'm in the middle of this scene. There's momentum here. Why do I feel like it's dragging? Sometimes it's dialogue. Sometimes it's a piece of information that maybe if I'd said earlier would have carried through this, and I've just put it down here, you know, has stopped the momentum, you know. Who came to the readings last night? The pieces that Andrew and Jan read were remarkable. I'm not like a thriller writer at all. And so to me, what amazed me was their instinctive understanding of when to stop the reading. Both of those pieces stopped at exactly the point that I'm like, I really want to know what happens next. I mean, I went out and bought the books, and I hadn't read either. I'm like, wow, they sold. You know, they just had a startling, and it was really simple, deceptively simple. So, you know, they knew the detail to stop it on. And knowing your material, especially knowing where you're going with it, if you know the end of it, really, really helps pacing, I think. I'm somebody who usually knows the ends of his book. I usually know the whole book, pretty much, and so that helps. This is the first thing I've ever done where I'm totally winging it, and that I like working out of my comfort zone, but that doesn't mean it's comfortable. excellent question. I hope that wasn't terribly concrete, but I hope that was useful.
Yeah, yeah. It gets back to the editing again.
You know, pace is reinforced by editing. I do think that the way you write it, your feeling and the tension and the intensity does get translated onto the page as you write. And that's not something you necessarily want to mess with. But the refinement of that and the placement of it, sometimes, you know, the ordering of it, definitely is on revision, something that can be enormously improved. And also, you know, understanding that this doesn't work. I want this to be tense. And why isn't it? And sometimes you'll jack it up and slide a new scene under it, man. That's okay. You know, that's perfectly okay. I love the questions people ask here.
I have a question about whether or not you ever dictate.
Different part of my brain.
Can you read aloud?
Yeah, but put it into a dictaphone and then read.
If it works for you, that's great. That's a very different part of my brain working there.
Oh, okay.
You know what generates speech for me versus what.
Oh really?
Yeah, I think maybe through familiarity I might, and I think you're going to see a lot more of that as voice to text recognition is getting much more sophisticated. And there are writers who've done it. The Mark Twain autobiography that was recently released, he realized his voice is what is unique, and he dictated it. But Barbara Cartland dictated all of her books, and well, there you go. All 400 and something of them.
Thinking of it for evaluation purposes, like to see if you have the right pace and momentum.
I definitely, I think that's a good idea. I mean, if you want to listen to them later, absolutely. You know, especially if you're comfortable reading stuff like that, absolutely. You know, I think that's a great idea. If you've got the luxury of the time of being able to do that, absolutely. You know, that's a great piece of advice. Yeah. Just know when you're trying to sell it to yourself by getting the attention, you know, by increasing the tension and making, you're like, look, I'm really trying to dress a pig here. You need to know if you're doing that, right?
I find that I do it because for me, it's the auditory processing.
Okay.
Works better than the actual visual when I.
Then my recommend, if that works for you, by all means, do it.
I can't get through the editing part because I can't get on to the next part because I'm so busy with the.
Well, some of what we're talking about is perspective.
I feel that way too. It's like,
I think it's a Catholic school thing.
Stuff.
It's the nuns that used to come down on us. Yeah. You know, like, oh, you need to put a comma here, you know.
Anything that'll break that for you.
Yeah.
You know, what we're talking about here is perspective, is some distance from the work. And if that works for you, by all means. You know, if giving it to a friend works, if pretending you are an editor works, you notice that that's one of the through lines here, right? Is being able to have, to acquire something resembling objectivity. And that's difficult. For me, I really loved it when I would write my ass off all night. I'd just be really going on a book, blah, blah, blah. And I'd literally write till I fell asleep at the keyboard sometimes. I know that sounds like movie cliche stuff, but I did. And then you'd read it the next day, and I couldn't remember writing it. So I would read it with something approaching objectivity. You know, I had no emotional connection to it. I'm writing it going, damn, I'm good, right? You know, and so I'd read it and it was easier to, you know, and sometimes you throw things out. That you're like, but what I learned was, oh, this is a blind alley. But because of this blind alley, I know which way to go. So don't think of that as a waste, right? You know, I'm sure Rodin had things he wanted to do and he went, man, that's not it. But when he got to it, he knew that you wouldn't have done this without the failures, right? So I'm going off on tangents now, but this is all part of revision. You know, your mistakes are not mistakes. They're learning moments. We're going to have about 30 seconds to do this, so let me get to it. Probably the questions. My reason in this is to show you my process and the way I do all this stuff and all that. So we'll probably just do, if we're lucky, a paragraph. And I deliberately chose an action scene on this because I think action is kind of hard to write. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. I think action's hard to write because it's a good opportunity to talk about the things I've talked about: clarity, brevity, concision, conciseness, whatever the hell it is. So, what the hell page is that? 104. I get to find out if I have my magic writing pen.
Where's the date on there?
I do that. I don't send them off with the date. I do that because it lets me know. I just sometimes lets me know how long it took me to do all this. You know, whenever I wrote it, it's nice to go through it and go, really, that was, and I thought I wrote it yesterday. Not the productive little lad I thought. So, yeah, I just do that. I don't send it off with that. Okay. So, let's look at this real quickly. Let me look and see what the hell kind of time we have. I might just end up doing shadow bunnies for you.
5 minutes.
Oh, good God. All right. Reason go! Stunt revision. All right. All right, let's just look at the first couple lines here very quickly, all right? It's in the middle of this is a post-apocalyptic thing. I've got a 14-year-old girl in Griffith Park basically being attacked by hyenas. She's taken refuge in the back of a phone company van, and she's in dire straits. So naturally something's teeth, the hyena's teeth have popped so close to her wrist that she felt the wind of it. She's got a big knife. It was on her before she could swing again, and both hands came up to ward it and met its throat as it knocked her back amid the gear. The wind knocked from her, and its front paws scrabbling at her chest for purchase enough to open her up. Let's just stop there for a second. Okay. I mean, it's not terrible. There's some kind of vague transitions there of subject, you know. So this is what I mean about showing me in mind where who in the sentence there changes, right? Because I'm caught up in the momentum, and so the focus is a little blurry there, right? So let's see if I changed it. Okay, first of all, both hands. You got to be kidding me. Anybody have a magic marker? Any kind of marker, because mine seems to be not.
I have a Sharpie pen.
Hell yeah, Sharpies are. Okay. All right. Both hands? How about her hands? You know, hands plural? I'm sure there's two.
Yeah.
Okay, so her hands accomplishes. What does it do? It takes away the redundancy and keeps the focus on who the hell we're talking about, especially since it was on her and both hands came up. I'm like, really? Both the hyena's hands came up? Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty... That edit does a lot of things, right? Okay. I'm sure, yeah, toward... Deliberately... My handwriting's indecipherable, I'm sorry. I deliberately separated... I didn't want to say toward because then it wants... a noun, right? So to ward, I wanted the rhythm of this, toward the head. I didn't want to say to ward off. I liked the rhythm. There are times when I will take the chance of sacrificing meaning because I like the rhythm, and that is a very personal decision. So to me, her hands came up to ward the head and met its throat as it knocked her back amid the gear. Do you hear the rhythm? I mean, I'm not even reading it necessarily trying to accentuate that, but that's almost iambic pentameter, right? Before she could swing again, and her hands came up to ward the head and met its throat as it knocked her head back amid the gear, right? There's one little clunky bit there. I have a penchant for sentence fragments, especially in action, and I've grown to like it. I should tell you that the guy teaching the class on revision is one idiosyncratic and quirky writer. Okay, I am a compendium of quirk in my fiction now, and so some of these is really me kind of reinforcing quirks. But you know, that's what style is, right? Is a sort of distinct flavor. And for me, I like a lot of sentence fragments in action sequences. Um, I probably won't even put this in there. I added some detail. The Windhoek Farmer and its hind legs scrabbling to drive itself. I'm just going to read this because we don't have much time. The wind knocked from her and its hind legs scrabbling to drive itself forward into her and its front paws scrabbling. Now, I would change this now. I don't like the gerunds. I don't like the ing words. They're not active voice, right? So I would probably rearrange that sentence to say hind legs scrabbled, front paws scrabbled. I don't mind repeating the word. They'll tell you don't, but you know what? There's an urgency to that. You know, it's hind leg scrabbled, it's front leg scrabbled. You just feel like, oh boy, you know. There are times that that's okay. There are no rules for this stuff. You know, people will give you kind of statement, including me, all the time. And this is, again, I'll keep those two scrabbles, but I'll definitely not make them gerunds. Alrighty. Her right hand gripped the matted fur with the bowie handle pressed between the blade and the pressed between. Wow, I did pick a good one. Handle pressed between and the blade flat against the okay. This is good because I don't necessarily agree with all my corrections. And well, you know, you come back and you change them later. You know, there was it Oscar Wilde? He said, "Yeah, I spent all day revising and I ended up taking a comma out of the sentence and the next day I put it back in." I'm like, "I've been there, buddy." All right. So, with the bowie handle pressed between, my first reading of that is I want to add a word after between. Between what? But then I realize I've done it. It's a quirky phrasing. Her right hand grip matted fur with the bowie handle pressed between and the blade flat against the neck, you know, hands pressed between. And she smelled rank dead meat breath as it snapped above her, straining to nod down. I'm different. Yeah. It's kind of difficult to give you this without context, but I am deliberately running these sentences together by now.
Oh, okay.
Okay. At this point, I didn't read you the previous. What I usually do is read you the previous paragraph so you know what the hell's going on. At this point, I want this immediacy. I want a barrage of, oh, crap, right? I mean, this thing is on her. And sometimes, action, I want to break into very simple sentences. Sometimes, you're like, you want her desperation. You're just trying to deal with something. And so you're letting the fragmentation of the language, the lack of, you know, dividing sentences just be a barrage of images, right? So here it's got, the blade flat against the neck, and she smelled rank dead meat breath as it snapped above her, straining to nod down toward her, and she thought about the flat, beseeching look in the eyes of the man she'd seen killed by this creature's kin. And she yelled, I'm not using commas, and I'm doing it on purpose. It's a run-on sentence. I don't want anything interrupting. This is something that, miraculously, my publisher just doesn't seem to mind. I'm trying to drop, nowadays, punctuation wherever I can. I consider it a speed bump in the sentence. I don't recommend this to all of you. I do this. Those who can't teach. as she pushed with the left hand and turned the edge toward the throat and brought the handle toward herself so hard the brass cap hit her just under the ribs and knocked the wind from her. Ooh, and look, the claws, they weren't scrabbling. That's good. and in fact, as I look, I'd have no changes in that. That's definitely one. But with no, okay, this is what I mean about changes for rhythm. The claws against her scrabbled, but with no will behind them now. And the shrill, you know, it doesn't change the meaning, but it adds a certain rhythm and makes the transition to the and a little more natural, right? I'm obsessed with rhythm. And this, I tell you what, action is not the place to be fancy, all right? That time to forget the flowery Lord Byron-y nonsense. You know, the rubber's meeting the road. For the most part, gets simple. Anybody here read Cormac McCarthy?
Yeah.
That dude can be as flowery as anybody. I mean, he's up there, man. I love him. I'm just crazy for him. And he is purely poetic and lyrical. But when the bullets fly, that dude is Hemingway. You know, I think the adjectives can go out the window now, right? He's very simple. And sometimes I do that, and sometimes I decide I'm just going to throw grammar out the window and shovel at you, you know. And sometimes I decide it doesn't. I may go back to this when the book's done and simplify it, you know. I've done both. I've done action scenes of very simple sentences. I did an action scene once that was six unpunctuated sentences. Six unpunctuated pages. One line. And here was what was cool. No one noticed it. That's how you know it worked. Jan Burke said, I swear to God, I could not in 20 years come up with a line as good as. She said, writing is harder than it should appear. And I thought, you know, when you see Fred Astaire dance, you think, shit, I could do that, right? No, you can't. That's why he's so great. That tells me I've got 10 minutes. So, and again, these are personal decisions, and I'll let yourself change your mind on them. It's okay. Okay, so we're in the middle of all this nonsense now. Oh yeah, I slipped in the... I'll tell you why I changed this. I got rid of... Her hand slipped in the dying creature's blood. Her hands... I wanted the concrete imagery. I felt like suddenly the writer has stepped in to decide that for you. Like it's almost distracting to me. You know, even though it's just two words. Her hand slipped in the dying creature's blood. All of a sudden, I feel like I'm being told this. You know, she doesn't know it's a dying creature. She's just dead. So her hand slipped in the blood keeps me in this horrible thing, right? And it's really weird how two words that are perfectly fine can actually take away from what you're wanting to do there. For me, anyway, right? I like to get very concrete in the middle of things like this. It's not the time to ruminate about whether or not she's going to go to heaven when she dies. You know? Oh, yeah, this is also a pretty gross scene, huh? I noticed I did this now twice. So let's look at that. Do you notice as I talk? I actually am just now noticing. As I talk about it, I'm talking about it as if somebody else made these changes. I notice I did this. Mm-hmm. Let's find out why. let's look at that. The claws against her scrabbled, but with no will behind them now, and the shrill laugh had liquid in it, and she was blinded by a gout of blood in one eye before her hand slipped in the blood now jetting from its sever. What do you think? Do the nows stand out or do they work? Strangely, I think it does too. And again, I'm like, normally I would cut that.
Now for something different.
It's well,
modifying something different.
And to me, the whole paragraph is trying to be immediate. It is trying to be present tense and in your face. And so I'm getting rid of editorializing, but the now reinforces it. I think one more now would ruin it, you know, for whatever damn reason.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah, of course.
Not having read anything before and after here for context, I see you have a long page of dialogue or of narrative. Would you consider breaking anything up with dialogue, like she's talking to herself, or you can?
I have an internal narrative here. I don't punctuate my dialogue anymore. So.
Okay.
It's a miracle I'm published, really, isn't it? She tried to yell at the next combatant, but the breath for it would not come.
Okay.
Sparkling black edged her vision. Not now.
No, not now.
Now, I don't actually care if you think if she said that or not. The whole thing is you're in her head going, no, no, not now. No. You know? You know, and that goes straight from a third person narrative to indirect discourse with no transition. You know? And again, for me, that's the immediacy. I just want you there in that moment with her, in that van as best I can. And part of that is activating senses, you know, the smells and feels and all that. Don't show people the movie, right? Then they're watching. Inhabit the scene. Be in that scene. You've got a lot of senses. Don't just describe something you're looking at. Then we're spectators, right? I'm not one of those writers who thinks that television and movie is evil and is, you know, balkanize the state of entertainment. But I do think it has caused us to emphasize the visual to the extent that the ability to eidetically experience something you couldn't otherwise is a little watered down. You know, inhabit that scene. You know, walk, turn around in that room. It's okay. You know, this is what books can do that other media can't. Take advantage of that. It's not a bug, it's a function. Okay, so I can't go in anywhere near the detail on this as I wanted hopefully that's okay because you guys had a bunch of questions. And I'll actually not go a lot farther because you probably have more. Now this is something, again, I wouldn't normally do, right? Starting sentences with but and already, things like this seems usually a little weak. But, you know, again, the immediacy. She tried to stand and could not breathe. Already another hung in the passenger window. For me, there's something more urgent about that than just saying another hung in the passenger window. It goes from being a detail that the writer is giving you to I seem to have looked just past this to see it. I don't know why that does that. I couldn't explain that. But, you know, again, that sense of urgency, that sense of being crowded by this, seems to be reinforced by adding that. So this kind of crap is instinctive. I mean, you know, and again, you change your mind. Okay, I'll make this one more change, and then we'll look at it, and we'll ask whatever last questions we had. Okay. Now this is what I mean. Your question about timing, pace. This is a word example as opposed to a larger example. I like the thought of, there's this hyena hung in the passenger window like some spectator with a vested wager on the fight. To me is, now we've stopped that, and you're going to have your own opinion of what that expression is, but it's so ludicrous in that moment that it kind of works for me. But it's too wordy, right? So time to stop, you know, with a vested wager. Boom, what an anvil drop. I mean, what a, it's too wordy and clunky and fancy. Stop it, right? Don't. So, some spectator that had wagered on the fight. It sounds better, it's more accurate, and it doesn't take you out of the scene, you know? So there's a case of simplifying in order to reinforce your effect, I think. Okay, I'm gonna stop there. Of course, there's plenty, you know, and I didn't even do all the changes that are on this big piece of chicken scratch. Because you guys have been asking really great questions, and I'd like to end up being able to answer any more that you may have. Whose pen was this? Thank you very much, because once you do this and your pen doesn't write, you're like, and for my next act. Any questions? I throw a lot of information out in these, but you've got the rest of your life to deal with it. So.
You know, I really like your run-on sentence idea, uh-huh. Urgency in the riddle, because I think it does work in that. But how do you get, I mean, I took a class yesterday, and I was like, yeah, if you have poor grammar, punctuation, and you have run-on sentences, it's just going to go right back.
Like, yeah, look how much it hurt poor James Joyce. Huh? I said, look how much it hurt poor James Joyce and William Faulkner.
That was so long ago.
So,
I mean,
but how do you get by? Not everybody.
Oh, I'm not advising doing this.
No, but I like it and I think it works.
I think you should. Again, this is an art versus commerce question. You have to decide. I write my stuff knowing that I am probably limiting myself and my audience, but I also know I sleep better at night. Because I don't want to write things I don't care about or that don't reflect what I feel I do. And I feel that, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing it. It's amazing to make a living writing, making stuff up. It's amazing. So my decision is, yeah, but I've got a way I want to be as a writer. And if that costs me stuff, that's okay, you know. But you do learn to fight the good fight. There are things worth fighting about. Trust me, when I turn this in, I think my publisher is going to say, there are no quotation marks in the dialogue. Yeah. And I'm going to have to decide if I want to add them. And I honestly don't know. Is it worth not having a book published for? I don't think it is. I think it's worth trying to do. And considering how many other ridiculous things I do, do I want to fight about it?
But can you sit down and explain your rationale saying, I don't like the pause? I want this.
Look, the biggest compliment I think I ever got was when my novel Elegy Beach came out, and it's full of all kinds of quirks. I stopped using question marks unless you could not tell if it was. I'm like, why did you do that? Isn't that obviously a question to you? Uh-huh. Well, if you can't read it as a question, that's not my fault to me. I've started viewing like exclamation points as like that's a crutch. Mm-hmm. You know, if it isn't clear from your sentence, then there's something wrong with your dialogue. If it isn't clear, it's a question. Now, sometimes you need it. It's not. It's either declarative or... So I'd put it in. That was my rule. If it wasn't clear, I'd put it in. Otherwise, right? And I've got email from people going, everybody sounds like they have this lack of affect. And I'm like, well, you've just been trained to read a certain way. And I'm, you know what? It's clearly a question. I am asking a lot. But my publisher said, we are considering not hiring a proofreader for this book because we think that everything you're doing on purpose. And I said, that is possibly the best compliment I've ever gotten. Would you please, for the love of God, hire a proofreader? Because you can't proofread your stuff. But, I mean, the fact that my publisher went with that was astonishing to me. I turned that in going, oh, God, you know. So it's such a, I mean, that really, that's a hard thing. That, you know, that can be your Rubicon, man, is... changing this or not. You know, I changed the title. The Mortality Bridges title was Ferry Across the Mercy for decades. You know, I loved that title. And you live with that long enough, and then they say, we think it's too referential. And you go, that, and where do you get distance? And what you do is, I just sat down and wrote lists. What's the theme here, right? And blah, blah, blah. You write themes, and you write concrete. You write verbs and nouns, right? You write, and you start slamming them together. And I think Mortality Bridge is, I like the title very much. Mm-hmm. So is it worth fighting about? Here, 25 years. And I went, oh, but I didn't fight about it. If a bookseller and an agent are saying, yes, I like the title, but I can sell more copies at Mortality Bridge, has it compromised you artistically or not? And that's your decision. To me, I'm like, you know what? It's the same book, right? And I like this other title. So, I mean, that's a little beyond the purview of this, but, you know, your duty is always to the work, always to this. What are you trying to convey? If it needs to be more blue, it needs to be more blue. And if somebody says, I'll buy it if you make it more red, what is your vision here? You know? And that is always a personal decision. You know? I know that I don't have the readership on my... I'm not easy to read. I demand things from readers. Oh, well. Honestly, oh, well. I want everyone to read me, but I'm not willing to be a different writer for that. You know? But you'll notice I'm not here lecturing on how to be on the New York Times bestseller list either. Okay? But, you know, I kind of far deeper than I was just going to talk about how to take out the extra ands in your sentences and stuff. Anything else?
No. Well, I think the bottom line is there's two sets of rules. Cormac McCarthy doesn't have to use quotation marks, but I do.
Well, Cormac McCarthy didn't achieve any kind of success till he was 60. Yeah. He never had a book that had more than 2,000 copies in print.
What I mean is, those that are published have a different set of rules than us trying to get through the door.
Well, I just, you know, it just depends. It really depends on your point of view, on my first novel was fairly formulaic, and I just wanted to depart from that. It's not that I don't stand by it, but once I've done that, I'm like, I'd like to do different things now. So I was at least fortunate enough that, you know, yeah, I showed that I can do that and all that. But the truth is, if I were writing Ulysses at 19, I don't think that I think I'd have been like, you want this or you don't.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, that's an art versus commerce question, and there's not a right or wrong.
Yeah.
You know? You definitely indulge yourself with the understanding that you are going to have a harder fight. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm not advocating that by any means. You know? And I don't think it's wrong.
He didn't get published till he was 60?
He got published in very, very small editions.
Wow.
Blood Meridian had an edition of 2,000 copies.
That's amazing.
You know, All the Pretty Horses is what did it when he started writing Westerns.
Wow.
And to this day, I find it miraculous that people read him. He's tough. But they read at the level of story, and the stories are pretty classic and mythic. Anything else? Because I know we're running over, and I have another class that I have to go and figure out what the hell I'm going to talk about in 2 seconds here.
Thank you.
Thank you all so very much.
Yeah.